Hello and welcome to Encounter, abc.net.au/rn. I'm Kerry Stewart, and this week we're exploring the contentious issue of abortion. With a young couple facing criminal charges for using the abortion pill, RU486 in Queensland, it's a very timely issue. Since the early 20th century, the debate over abortion legislation in the West has been sometimes violent and always polarised. One side, often religious groups, argue that abortion is killing life and making it illegal will stop that. The other side, saying that abortion is removing only tissue from a woman's body, so it's her choice.
Those are the two that go on battling within at least the United States, those two positions. What interested me, and part of the reason that I got studying the Japanese approach, is that it's really a third position. It says, we'll keep abortion legal. You know, we've had already a history of having it criminalized, and it wasn't very good during the long period of our imperialism, when women were encouraged to have as many babies as possible. It led to all kinds of bad things. And then we don't want to just say that abortion is just, you know, like having a tooth pulled. It is a very complicated emotional, psychological thing, as well as a physical development. And we are therefore going to have, not by government sponsorship, we're just going to let the religious institutions develop a ritual that can be of assistance here. By the way, I think it's worth noting that, at least by my research, the earliest examples of this ritual were not sponsored by Buddhist temples. They were initiated by women themselves.
Dr. William Lafleur, Professor of Japanese and Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and author of Liquid Life, Abortion and Buddhism in Japan. And we'll find out about the Buddhist abortion ritual he was talking about a little later, and how it's made its way from Japan to America. We'll also find out about the situation for women in the Buddhist country of Thailand, where abortion is illegal. Buddhist views about abortion are varied and are often influenced by the history and culture of the country where it's practiced. But there are some overarching principles that have helped people through the landscape of ethical decision-making. Today, we're going to delve into the Buddhist understanding of when life begins and the ethics associated with abortion in Asia and America. But first, the Australian federal government last month amended the AusAid Family Planning Guidelines, which overthrew a 12-year ban on funding for NGOs that performed abortions in countries where it's legal. Ari Laufer is the executive officer of one of those organisations, Mari Stopes International Australia.
Approximately one woman dies every 7 minutes because of maternal mortality in the Pacific Asia region. And the changes to the family planning guidelines will have a big and significant impact to those women. And we'd like to commend Minister Smith and Parliamentary Secretary McMullen for those changes to the guidelines. I've travelled to many communities, I've lived in many countries, and I've seen the impact of unsafe abortion. When you walk into a maternal ward in a country such as Burma, in, for example, Rangoon General Hospital, where you see, and you can smell, it's the smell of death, it's the smell of septicemia, where women have tried to self-abort because they've not had any access to family planning and they have too many children, they're in desperate poverty and they have no other option but to put sticks within themselves or use herbal remedies. And many of these women die unnecessarily every year. Part of the argument we've said all along is about why women in Australia can access certain services, particularly abortion education and services, yet under the Australian Aid Program, they were not able to access these services in countries such as Vietnam or China or Mongolia where abortion is legal. This is unethical, and I think the changes brought about by the changes in the family planning guidelines will allow a more ethical view about how Australia's relationship with its neighbours and also in terms of how organisations can operate at a very human-to-human level.
And are we following a trend here? I mean, Barack Obama also lifted restrictions on abortion funding in January this year. What effect has that had?
Well, there has been a world trend. The Obama government has changed and softened their guidelines compared to the Bush government. The European Union, particularly the Dutch, have increased their money towards safe abortion. And Australia is following that trend.
Ari Laufer from Marie Stopes International Australia. The Buddhist countries where the organisation operates are Burma, Mongolia, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia and China. One of the Buddhist countries where they don't work is Thailand, because abortion is only permitted to save a mother's life or if a pregnancy is a result of rape or incest. Dr. Andrea Whittaker is a medical anthropologist and has conducted research in one of the poorest regions of Thailand, the northeast, where people are devout Buddhists and subsistence rice farmers. Her research was to gain an understanding of women's experiences of illegal abortions.
On the whole, poverty determines the risk in abortion. Women who are wealthy, so women in the urban middle classes, can access medically supervised abortions that are safe, so they usually don't experience much in the way of complications. But the poorer women with whom I was working in village areas, rural areas, who may not have access to such clinics and may not have the money to access such clinics because the price is really high, because that's the other effect of the illegality, those women end up resorting to untrained practitioners, and they do things like massage abortions or the really dangerous injection abortions, where injections are put per vagina. Those are cheap, but they're incredibly dangerous abortions. The important thing is that these laws exist within the criminal code and they are enforced. So you do see very public raids upon clinics and jail terms and fines for both doctors but also women who have undergone abortions.
Women in the countries we work in are not dissimilar to the women in Australia. They find themselves with a lack of family planning and they find themselves in a situation where family planning goes wrong. For Marie Stopes International Australia, most of our centres are targeting marginalised women where they have no access to safe abortion. I've recently come back from Myanmar, and you can go to these post-cyclone areas in the Delta, which many of the listeners would know about. And these women have six, seven, eight children. They're already, their houses have been destroyed, and they financially cannot afford an eighth or a ninth child.
And I imagine getting contraception would be very difficult. I mean, they could hardly get clean water.
In post-cyclone Nargis, Myanmar, access to food and to shelter is a difficult problem. And I think many NGOs are working alongside the government to really provide an improved service. I've visited these areas myself, and indeed you'd be happy to know that we actually provide a lot of our services in the Buddhist monastery because it was the only place remaining that we could, and the monks welcomed us. We provided general health care as well as sexual reproductive health care services to the women of the villages and including to the Buddhist monks.
This was a Burmese metta chanting, chanting on loving kindness.
Thailand is predominantly a Buddhist country, so does religion play a part in the government's decision to have such restrictive abortion laws?
Thailand's always had restrictive abortion laws. The earliest sort of written laws of the Three Seals Laws in 1805 restricted abortion, and various amended versions of the laws have always restricted abortion since then. So in a sense, although those laws do have a Buddhist fundamental origin, on the whole, religion hasn't really determined the nature of those laws, but it did determine the nature of attempts to reform the laws. And throughout the 1980s, there were various attempts by various groups and politicians to reform the 1957 Criminal Code to make the law less restrictive. However, through that time, there was the rise of a fundamentalist Buddhist sect called the Santia Sorg, and one of its leaders was a major general called Major General Jamlong Simuang, who was a highly influential political figure and mobilised a highly emotive campaign against any reform, using Buddhist arguments and ethno-nationalistic sort of arguments. So he depicted abortion as yet another form of Western moral corruption, which was destroying Buddhist values. He equated the West with free sex and free sex with what he was terming free abortion, and essentially gave the message that abortion was therefore un-Buddhist and anti-religion and therefore fundamentally un-Thai. And he set up a political party called the Palangtam, which means the moral force, and this was highly successful. He was elected twice as governor of Bangkok from 1985 until 1992. And through that period, it was impossible for any amendments to go through parliament. Today, if you go to Thailand, I think the majority of Thais would argue that, and they'll use the term, that there is a need for a middle path on ethical issues such as this. And they would not necessarily take quite as hard a line on the issue. So many women's groups, the Thai Medical Council, the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, many Buddhist bioethicists recognise that in certain circumstances abortion may be necessary, and hence don't necessarily make these very strong links between Buddhist action, Thai-ness and abortion. But this was certainly something which was mobilised and potentially can be mobilised to make these very strong religious arguments against abortion reform.
Why are these Asian countries' reproductive health and family planning facilities in need of so much assistance? I mean, is there a resistance from governments or religious groups, or just a lack of trained medical professionals?
In many of the countries across the Asia-Pacific region, access to family planning and sexual reproductive health services is very limited. There's a lot of constraints on government health systems. And of course, many of the priorities are based around immunisation, around newborns, as well as treating emergencies and issues such as malaria. And unfortunately, family planning falls down that list. So Murray Stopes International Australia works often with governments or in partnership with governments to provide sexual reproductive health services. We also work alongside some of the government doctors and government midwives, for example, in Vietnam and Cambodia, improve the quality of the services. We can fill a gap while the ministries of health there are trying to improve their own health services at this point of time.
There's a whole range of differences between Buddhist countries across Southeast Asia in terms of their laws. And in general, countries with Mahayana Buddhist traditions, as practiced in places like Japan and Korea, China, Taiwan and Vietnam, show a much greater tolerance for abortion than those with Theravadan Buddhist traditions, such as Thailand, Burma, Laos and Sri Lanka. However, there are differences in this pattern. So, for example, Cambodia, which is Theravadan Buddhist, has also some of the most liberal laws in the whole region. So Cambodia and Vietnam, although from slightly different Buddhist traditions, have extremely liberal laws. Now, how do we explain this? The difference is not necessarily in the religion practiced, but the degree to which religion is associated with state legitimation. And this varies from country to country across Southeast Asia. It depends upon the colonial histories, the legal structures that they inherited by states, the degree to which religion is mobilised as a unifying force in nationalist projects by the state, contemporary political histories, and importantly also the growth of politically active fundamentalist religious movements such as the Santia Sok in Thailand. So to put it simply, the difference across the regions, the differences in the legal status of abortion is not necessarily about religion, but I'd suggest that it's when religion and nation become mutually supportive that you can expect that there's the enforcement of restrictive abortion laws and very intense sanctions against abortion.
Dr. Andrea Whittaker, author of Abortion, Sin and the State in Thailand. Let's look deeply now into the Buddhist teachings, and in particular, the first precept of not killing. Dr. Jan Chosen Bays is a paediatrician working in the area of child abuse, a Zen Buddhist priest, and co-abbot of Great Vow Monastery in Oregon in the United States.
In terms of the first precept about not killing, of course that's a primary precept. If we can, in our life, not harm other lives. That's the best. But when we look at our life, it depends on the sacrifice of other lives. So even if we're pure vegetarians, we're sacrificing the life of plants at least. So a real fact of a human life is that for us to live, many beings, hundreds of millions of beings, have to die. So to really honor that life, to express our gratitude for that life, the sacrifice of that life, and to hold and cherish that life as part of our life is our primary spiritual practice from the Zen Buddhist point of view. So non-harming is the highest principle, but its counterpart is to cherish all life. So if a being were emerging into life and we realized, oh, this person is going to be born into very difficult circumstances, then what's the best choice? Is the best choice to take a more rigid point of view and say, oh, this child must be born, no matter what the circumstances of its life, no matter what suffering it will undergo for the next 30, 50, 60 years of its life? So is that cherishing life to endorse that? Or is it cherishing life to say, no, this is not the optimal time for this little spark of life to emerge, and we will pray for it to emerge at a better time, to flower where it could flower and be loved? And no one says it's an easy decision, but it's a decision that each individual has to make for themselves.
Right to life movements would say, well, that person could always adopt that child out.
But you know, having worked in the field of child abuse and adopted children and so on, that's not what happens. I've often said if the Right to Life movement had a stronger arm which guaranteed that every child's life would be optimal, that did find good homes for all of those children and did provide education and did follow them year after year to make sure that the home they were placed in is a loving home, that'd be different. But that's not happening. So there's guilt put on people for making difficult decisions. And many of those children, because I've seen them over the years as a pediatrician and working in child abuse, they end up in miserable circumstances, and nobody's watching that. Nobody's watching that happen.
Dr. Carmen Lecce-Somo is an associate professor in theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego in California. She's also a Tibetan nun, and when I spoke to her in Leh Ladakh, she was travelling to monasteries in the remote valleys of northern India as part of a project to help women achieve equal opportunities for education, healthcare, and ordination. A central question in the abortion debate is, when does life begin?
Traditionally, for Buddhists, life begins at conception. However, in recent years, His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that if it could be shown that the consciousness of the being does not enter the fertilized ovum until some later time, then we would need to revise our thinking about this issue. And we know, for example, that a fertilized ovum is not viable until it attaches to the wall of the uterus. Therefore, if we could determine, and so far we don't have the technology, but if we could at some future time determine that the consciousness does not enter the fertilized ovum until it attaches to the wall of the uterus, then we could conclude that perhaps terminating the pregnancy before that time is not a serious ethical transgression.
Are there different views of when life begins according to what Buddhist tradition is followed? And does culture play a big part?
There are different views within the different Buddhist traditions. After all, the Buddha taught some 5 centuries before Christ, and the Buddhist teachings were transmitted to many different cultures. So in each case, interpretations of Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist thought differed according to the circumstances of that particular culture and the indigenous beliefs of the people that lived there before Buddhism was introduced. So we may find Buddhists who, for example, find that life does not really begin until birth, for example.
To Theravadan Buddhists, like most Buddhists, believe that life begins at conception. And in my work with Buddhist women in northeast Thailand, there was no disagreement on that. They also believe that the destruction of those beginnings of life did constitute bap, which is a Buddhist demerit. So this would have karmic consequences for one's status and reincarnation in the future. But for village women, they made distinctions between very early pregnancies, which they described as gon luet, which is a term that means a lump of blood. And this is consistent with Thai views, very ancient texts, in fact, Thai ethnomedical views of the beginnings of life, which views pregnancy as a very fluid thing which may or may not form into a human. However, at the time of quickening, when women felt flutterings in their womb, that was then defined as the beginning of a human life form, and abortion after that point, after around 3 to 4 months, was considered a very serious form of Buddhist demerit.
Dr. Andrea Whittaker. The idea of life being fluid is explored by William Lafleur in his book Liquid Life. So what did he find was the Japanese Buddhist understanding of the beginning of life?
The whole matter of coming into the world and leaving the world are, I think, within Japanese Buddhism, a process that I call more fluid than anything, at least in American Christian circles, you will find. There's no great interest in trying to say that at some very specific point, for instance, conception, there is now a human being. It's a process. And to say that we know at what point we have a human being there in the womb, a human being with an inviolate life, seems to most Japanese just a little bit outrageous. And therefore, there is a certain sense that since it is a process, we have to make our moral decisions in those terms.
And I love your description of it, sort of like a densification at the beginning and a thinning at the end. Can you just talk about that?
Yes, I became very interested in looking at actually some medieval Buddhist materials in Japan that described coming into the world as a human being as I use the word densification. What is developing within the body of a woman is a human being who will become more and more fully human as the process goes. And it extends even after birth to some extent. While a child is still a child, at least until the age of 15, I'm talking now about the medieval period, it was considered to be, well, human, but also still with the mind and the sensibility of someone who is connected to the world of the gods and the Buddhas. Now, there I'm talking about some notions that were more clear in the medieval period than they are today. But I think there's some carryover of that into the modern period. The other side of the life cycle is the same way. When people become elderly, we don't expect them to take quite as much responsibility for things of this world, as we say, as they did. And in Japanese traditional way of thinking, it was thought that they were, in fact, becoming, even while alive, increasingly part of the world of the gods and Buddhas.
You're listening to Encounter, abc.net.au/rn. This week, we're exploring abortion from a Buddhist perspective. So what's the Buddhist ethical framework used when making a decision about whether to abort or not? Tibetan nun Karma Lekche Somo is speaking from the remote town of Leh in the Himalayan region of India.
When I talk about these issues, I frame it in terms of pro-life, pro-choice. That, of course, Buddhists in ideal circumstances would want to support life and nurture life. However, it is always a woman's decision to make the choice whether to have a child or not. And this, of course, comes within the ethical framework of actions and consequences.
when making that ethical decision, do things like right intention, part of the Eightfold Path, are they important to be aware of?
Right intention plays a big part in Buddhist ethical decision-making. This was the twist that the Buddha put on understanding of karma, the law of cause and effect, during his own lifetime. The theory of cause and effect, or karma as we know it, can sometimes be interpreted very sort of fatalistically or deterministically, as if we have no choices in our lives because, well, we've already created these causes. We're going to be poor. What can we do about it? And so forth. But the Buddha said our karma starts now, moment to moment. The actions that we create with our body, speech, and mind are a moment-to-moment activity. Therefore, we have to be very mindful, very conscious of the decisions that we make. The other important aspect of the Buddha's interpretation of the law of cause and effect was the importance that he gave to the intention with which we create action. But of course, we have to be very honest with ourselves when we look at our intentions. How much self-interest is involved, and how much are we sincerely concerned with or acting out of compassion for our families or for that living being? How can we know, for example, how we are affecting the karma of others?
The Asian form of Buddhism looks at ethical decisions in a very broad way. And this actually goes along with the research on the stages of moral development. For example, in reference to abortion, the simplest stage is I do what I want and everybody back off. If I want an abortion, I'll have an abortion. If I want to keep my kid, I'll keep my kid. And it's nobody else's business. That's the simple, self-centered stage of moral development. The next stage of moral development says, oh no, there are rules. Life should be supported. Life should be cherished. So we have commandments like do not kill, cherish all life, do not steal, do not lie. And we need to obey those commandments or those precepts. We have those precepts in Buddhism, and we try to follow them as much as we can. But that becomes black and white. Well, if you don't follow the precepts, then you're damned, or you've sinned, and you're terrible. And I follow the precepts, I'm good. It's got some principles, which is wonderful, as opposed to I just make my own decisions. It has some overarching principles. And so a society adopts those principles, which is wonderful. We like a society that says you can't kill other people and get away with it. There are consequences for that. But then the next stage of moral development encompasses all of that and says, but every circumstance is different. So that's where you get, say, a judicial decision that really looks at the situation carefully and tries to take everything into account and make a wise and compassionate decision. So in Buddhism, we say we look at the people involved, we look at the place, we look at the time, we look at the intention, and we look at the amount. So those are the things that go into making an ethical decision. So from that highest point of view, the more evolved moral development, stage of moral development, you would look at, okay, what's the circumstance of this family or this single mother? Let's say she was raped and she's pregnant. I've done a study on sexually abused boys, and most of those boys grow up without fathers. And the ones in the worst circumstance are the ones that are the product of rape. Not only do they not have a father, they have a father whom their mother hates. An imaginary father, but they know the mother hates the father and is likely to hate any characteristics that appear in this child that remind her of that situation or that father. So that's a hellish realm to be born into, frankly. And those boys are much, much more likely to be sexually abused because the predators see them as very easy prey. Little boy looking for a man, a role model. And so they move in on those boys very, very quickly. So, you know, the broader your point of view, the more you know, the more complex it is. But we have to be patient with complexity. The Dalai Lama says, patience with complexity is one of our most difficult spiritual tasks.
You've said in your book that in modern Japan, women name and feel like the fetus is a child. They don't say it's just tissue or it's an unwanted pregnancy. So they actually do recognise, and this makes it very complex, consequently, that this thing growing inside them is a child, don't they?
Japanese women who do go to a temple or some kind of sacred site in order to really offer an apology to the fetus that they have had aborted tend to think of that fetus, even if aborted at a fairly early stage, as having had a human existence of some sort. They don't know empirically whether it was a human or not, but I think they feel that it's better to be, what shall we say, on the side of conceptual safety. Even though it's going to be aborted, and even though apology will be made to it in that context, to think of it only as some kind of tissue is to add insult to injury.
In general, too, in Buddhist countries, of course, we all make mistakes. We all create unwholesome actions. But there are always ways to outweigh, if not to repair, at least to outweigh our ethical transgressions by doing good deeds. For example, if you were to take the life of a being, but then you were to go and save the lives of 100 living beings, then that would certainly help to balance out one's karma. They say that whereas a tablespoon of salt tastes very salty in a glass of water, a tablespoon of salt in a huge lake doesn't make the water that salty. In the Tibetan Buddhist world, there are many practices that one can do, everything from study to meditation to tantric rituals and so forth, for creating wholesome karma, but none that I know is specifically aimed at counteracting the karma of having an abortion.
For a woman to deny another life force, an incarnation, is considered a very negative act, a source of considerable demerit because you're not allowing another life force to reincarnate into this life. And women recognise that, women who aborted, sometimes asked the baby to come back to them at another time or in a next life. So it's considered, abortion is considered to bring demerit to the woman and it brings bad karmic consequences for the fetus as well.
So how do the women minimise the bad karma that they believe will be a consequence of the act of aborting?
In Thailand, the bad karma that one generates through the act of abortion can only really be balanced, if you like, through meritorious acts in this life. So the women who aborted within the village, and these were women who regularly went to the temple, regularly gave alms to the monks and fed the monks, would tend to do more of that. And perhaps at a time in their life, they would also enter the temple themselves for various periods to undertake meditation and generally would try very hard to make merit in this life as much as possible to balance the demerit that they had undertaken through their act of abortion. In some cases, because Theravadan Buddhism doesn't have rituals to appease the spirits of aborted fetuses, as in other traditions, there was no formal institutional means to recognise this act. And I found that women sometimes made up their own rituals. So they would go to the temple and would make up rituals to attempt to make merit for the fetus that they had aborted.
Dr. Andrea Whittaker's research looked at the experiences of Buddhist women in northeast Thailand who had illegal abortions. In Japan, a specific ritual has developed to acknowledge the aborted fetus. It's called Mizuko Kuyo, and at the centre of this ritual is Jizo, a figurine of a young monk. Zen Buddhist priest Jan Chosen Bays has written a book called Jizo Bodhisattva.
The name Bodhisattva means awakened being or a being made of enlightenment. So what does that mean? Well, that means a being that's made of equal parts of wisdom and compassion. Then Jizo, the two Chinese characters for Jizo, Ji means earth, and Zo means treasury or womb or storehouse. So the literal meaning is the womb of the earth or the treasury of the earth. So everything that comes from the earth, and if you think about it, if you look around where you happen to be sitting right now, you'd see that everything comes from the earth. So how did Jizo become especially associated with abortions or miscarriages in Japan? I think this began centuries ago when women, of course, had miscarriages. It's very common. So as part of their appealing to Jizo to protect them during pregnancy, if the pregnancy wasn't successful and the baby died, there would naturally be prayers to Jizo to help this child as it passes on to whatever realms of existence come next. But then during World War II, Jizo took on a new and special significance, because before World War II, the Japanese government had encouraged its citizens to have large families, because they were expanding, they were in Manchuria and so on, they had colonies, and so they wanted to increase the number of citizens. But then when they lost World War II, which came as a big shock to most Japanese people, and they had to repatriate all the soldiers and all of the people in their colonies, and the conditions in the country were terrible because all the cities had been firebombed and essentially destroyed, and many people were living in shacks or out in the open or in caves and starving to death, and TB was rampant. And, of course, there was all the damage from the atomic bombs. So the government had to abruptly reverse its policy, and they enacted the Eugenics Act, which made abortion a legal form of birth control and asked people to limit their families. So this was a huge reversal for the population, a huge change psychologically. And this form of birth control, abortion, became really the only form of birth control that was used in Japan until the year 2000, when the birth control pill became legal, January 2000. So many women in this era after World War II, up until modern times, would have as many as 8 or 10 abortions. And there was no religious framework to help support them in their grief over this reality of life. They're a very difficult choice. So the Mizuko Jizo and the Mizuko ceremony evolved at that time.
The Japanese word most commonly used today for a fetus that is being aborted is mizuko. Mizu means water, ko means child. It's a water child in the sense that it is a child who is not going to ever be, in a sense, what we might call solidly here. At least not now. It may in some future incarnation, but not now. The other word is kuyo. And kuyo is a very generic word for saying thanks and gratitude in a ritualized form. One of the things I was struck while looking at Japanese temples was the fact that there were actually little placards often hanging on a temple site with inscribed on them a little note of apology with a name behind it and addressed to, not to a named child, but to the Mizuko of this family X. And it says, we are sorry this had to take place, and we wish you the best as you make your trajectory into a new home. You know, it's sentimental, but it's simple. And I think it's probably emotionally quite meaningful.
This water baby ceremony came about as a way to acknowledge these difficult decisions that families were making, life and death decisions. And it's a very lovely ceremony, actually. And many temples do it still in Japan. And it provides a lot of spiritual solace for families. Often they'll buy a statue of a Jizo, and a very childlike-looking Jizo, so it's in memory of their child and actually represents their child. And then there are special cemeteries where there are hundreds of these Jizos. And the families will go several times a year and make offerings, bring toys and food and a new bib that the mother has made and or a hat. And then the living children will come too, and they'll honor this child who's not with them anymore, but is with them in spirit. And it's very, very touching. They'll often bring food that's appropriate to the current age of the child that's no longer with them. So one woman told me, oh, yes, at 16, when my child who passed on from abortion, was 16, I brought a McDonald's hamburger to offer for her because I thought, well, that's what she would like. So these children are very much alive in their hearts and their minds. And often the Jizo cemeteries are right next to a playground. So there are living children there right next to this place where they remember the children who've died, which is very touching. So life and death are right next to each other in Japan.
Can you talk about the importance of ritual, sort of like a poetry that human beings take up with their bodies, I suppose? Mm.
Yes. I mean, ritual is so much like poetry. It expresses feelings and also often concepts that are not always perfectly clear and rational. It brings together the emotional and the conceptual. And besides, we do rituals with our bodies. It's not just a mental thing we do. We have to do something when we do rituals. And I think that's why people are quite ready and willing to do it in this case, too.
Dr. William Lafleur, author of Liquid Life, Abortion and Buddhism in Japan. The first Mizuko ritual in America was conducted in the 1970s by Yvonne Rand, a Zen Buddhist priest in California. Women and their families still come to her meditation center to acknowledge the loss of a child through abortion, miscarriage, stillbirth, and death after birth. Jan Chosen Bays, co-abbot of Great Vow Monastery in Oregon, participated in one of the early ceremonies.
I was really stunned at how this very, very simple ceremony, mostly conducted in silence, had lifted this burden of sorrow from my heart. And I thought, we have to do this ceremony in Oregon. This is a gift to people that we must offer. And so we've been offering it for over 10 years now.
And what's the response from people? I mean, how many people come along and are they Buddhists?
Well, the number of people that come to the ceremony varies. So we might have 4 people or families or couples, or we might have 30 people. We never know. We just send out announcements to places that might be handling working with families who are grieving, to other religious groups, to hospices, to an organization that works with children's grief, to chaplains, hospital chaplains. And then the kinds of people that come, I would say over half are not Buddhist. They may have read a little bit about Buddhism, but they're not practitioners. They have some other religious tradition. And we do the ceremony, and I explain the origin of the ceremony to put in context and show them some pictures of Jizos in Japan so they see what this is like in Japan, Jizo gardens, Jizo cemeteries, and Jizo figures in Japan. And then explain what we're going to do. And then we go into silence and people make remembrance tokens. And that period is the most profound period because people often go into a sort of trance state when they're making this remembrance token. It's amazing to watch. So we've had whole families come, living children, remembering a child who, say, died of heart disease in infancy. And it's palpable in the room that there's this container that's able to hold these different kinds of grief. And this acknowledgement that no matter how our child died, whether it was a therapeutic abortion or a miscarriage or a sudden infant death or an accident, the grief is the same. So we spend about an hour and a half making those tokens. And when everybody's ready, then we do a procession up to the Jizo Garden. And at our monastery, the Jizo Garden is the second heart of the monastery. The first heart is our meditation hall. And then the second heart is this Jizo Garden.
In me jiku kanon gyo. Kanse on da bu.
ceremony has also found its way to some Australian Zen Buddhist centres. Back in modern Japan, some Mizuko rituals are now big business. Entrepreneurs concoct stories of spirits of dead fetuses, wreaking revenge if families don't pay large sums of money for the rituals and memorial sites they offer. This is a very effective way of compounding the guilt and sorrow felt by women who've had abortions. Traditional temples still conduct the ritual without cost. So can Buddhist ethics and rituals help women in the West to make a decision and come to terms with that decision about abortion? Zen priest Jan Chosen-Bays again.
The difficulty, I think, in incorporating the Buddhist point of view, in at least in American society right now, is it's very comforting to fall back on black and white. It's hard, as I mentioned before, to hold the complexity of every situation, every political situation, every social situation is very complex. There are no simple answers. And Buddhism likes to embrace the complexity and consider the complexity and then make choices, wise choices that take into account as much as we can the human condition.
I'm wondering whether the acceptance through ritual of the abortion that one might have had is a way it could be seen as condoning abortion. Do you think that's the case?
It's a complicated but really good question. I think to a certain extent it says we are making cultural provision. We're allowing within our religious system there to be abortion, and we have a way of handling the morals of it, at least the guilt over the morals. If that is condoning it, I suppose it is. On the other hand, I'm not sure I like the alternative.
I don't think that these ceremonies condone abortion at all. My experience is the people who come to the ceremonies who have had abortions are carrying a very deep grief, and they need a place to acknowledge that grief. And that grief arises from love for that little speck of life. It doesn't disappear from their awareness. So we need to support them in taking that energy of love and turning it from suffering into support for themselves and for their living children and for other people.
That brings us to the end of this encounter about abortion from a Buddhist viewpoint. My thanks to Jan Chosen-Bays, William Lafleur, Karma Lecce Somo, Andrea Whittaker and Ari Laufa. For more information, go to our website, abc.net.au/rn/encounter, where you'll also find a transcript of this program. Technical production today was by Phil McKellar. I'm Kerry Stewart, and it's been good to have your company.
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst, for they are sticking to their diets. Laugh we may at this modern wisdom, but my next guest on our creative thinking series, Susie Orbach, says it's now way out of hand.
Now we no longer see the body as biological. We see it as something that we have to shape, as though the body was simply a dress or a kitchen or something that could be in our own image.
You can join Susie Orbach and myself, Geraldine Doogue, by downloading Saturday Extra from the Radio National website.